This is November 10th, 2008, and this is our third session with Bob Carr, and we're going through his book, God Men, Con Men. And I'm looking at page 79, and it says, Robert writes, it was 1957, and in one of my many trips to Vancouver, BC, I made the acquaintance of a psychologist who was experimenting with new psychotropic drugs, using them to treat patients for a variety of disorders and substance abuse. Who is that psychologist, Bob?
Al Hubbard.
Now, how did you come across him? I mean, how did you even hear of him?
Well, after I got LSD from Sandoz, they sent it, you know, in a little glass vial. It had to be weighed out into smaller increments because it's so very, very tiny, the amounts that are used. I think the vial was 100 milligrams, and we needed to break that down into 5 milligrams each. So we could dilute that into 100 microgram trips for people. So I found a biochemist, had a lab in North Seattle, and I called him and asked him if he could do it. He said, yeah. So I went out there, and then, of course, he was interested in what I was doing, and I told him, and he said, that's interesting, because he said, I have an inquiry from somebody in Canada about making LSD for them. And he went through his file and produced a letter, showed it to me. It was from Al Hubbard, and requesting him to make LSD if he could. And so he gave me the telephone number, and so later I called Hubbard and told him very briefly what I was doing, not much, and he suggested that we meet in Vancouver. And so after some time, a few days, I flew up to Vancouver, and I met him at the airport, and we went into a kind of a some sort of a small room that in the airport, and we had about a two-hour discussion about what I was interested in. And anyway, so the first meeting was more or less just a feeling each other out, and I got a good feeling from him. I liked him. He was very, very cordial and nice. And he suggested that we get together again. And I'm not sure whether he came to Seattle first on one of his many trips to Seattle and visiting the center, or I went back to Vancouver and met him at his apartment and his wife. Anyway, he became a source of information about psychedelic experiences. And I realized that he had a background. He'd been doing this for some time. He said he started with peyote some years back that he got from the Indians in the desert in Nevada. And so anyway, we became friends, and he kept me well informed, and often gave me samples of new materials that he was getting. And so he made a lot of trips to Seattle and visited the center, and you know, we became somewhat friends. And then, of course, when I later closed the center, I lost track of him completely. But
okay, so when you meet with him in the airport, what did you say you were doing? You had just had some LSD through Elliot Craig, yeah. And then Stan Collins had gotten you the Sandoz connection. Did you read up on LSD before you went and met Hubbard? Did you study what it is, what it was?
I didn't know anything about LSD, except there was very little information. I mean, first, no internet, and everyone seemed very vague about it, you know. The University of Washington was conducting experiments with it and other drugs, for the U.S. government, CIA, I guess. And but I didn't know about that then. I only learned that later through my association with Agyananda, who was attached to the Far East Department at the University of Washington, and he had a German friend, a teacher there, who was doing the research. But they were very tight-lipped about just what they were doing. But I did know that the university was experimenting. They did have LSD and were doing some kind of research with it. Mescaline also. And other drugs. They were conducting drugs tests up and beyond 1970. They were still doing experimental work. Because I had a friend who was a student who was in some of the programs that were doing experiments. They were doing experiments with mind-altering substances that would confuse and dehinge, unrange people as a biological weapon for the army.
Right.
Agyananda
told you while the center was still open they were experimenting at the University of Washington?
He just knew what a professor there who was doing the research, and he was a German, and so they had a contact because Agyananda was Austrian, and both had, you know, and this other fellow had come over to the U.S. and gotten a job teaching and doing research at the University of Washington. I can't remember his name right now, but it was all kind of hush-hush and, you know, paranoid and secretive and so forth. But
right,
Agyananda
tells you this before 1960?
Yes.
Right, so you found out, you didn't know it was the government, but you and wasn't so secretive or paranoid.
I surmised that. Yeah, I surmised.
You surmised it. So yeah. You would have been one of the first people in the public to know about MKUltra or about that, what became known as MKUltra later.
Possibly, but I didn't pay much attention to it. So.
Yeah. It didn't seem that sinister what they were doing.
Right. I didn't know any of the details until much, much later on after reading about it.
But
Hubbard was connected with a Myron Stolaroff in Palo Alto who was one of the founders of Ampex, and he made enough money to retire early, and he had an LSD center there where they were giving LSD and experiment. I think Alan Watts, I'm not sure, but I think Alan got his trip there. Could be wrong. Might have been in Southern California because they were doing research there with LSD. But Hubbard was connected with all these people, and he showed me some letters he had received from Aldous Huxley, and he was kind of proud of that. Gave him a certain status, I believe. But anyway, so Hubbard was the Johnny Appleseed of LSD, as it later turned out from finding out about it just last year. But I knew that he had been traveling to Switzerland. He had made contacts with Hoffman, and he was well connected all over the world with LSD studies. His primary interest was to make it a bona fide tool for psychotherapy, helping people with uncover their problems and to see if they could turn their lives around. Of course, they were working with alcoholics and drug abuse, people with general background, and they were getting a success rate. How long the success rate lasted, I don't know. I did some experiments with some people that had been taking alcohol, were addicted, and in one session, it turned their lives around. So I had my own therapeutic structure, different than Hubbard's, because Hubbard's was more or less involved with a lot of Catholic symbolism. And he was a Catholic, Roman Catholic, and the big difference was that I, you know, wasn't any part of any Western tradition at all. I was interested in Krishnamurti and Indian thought. But Hubbard knew something of it, but not a great deal. He acknowledged that, you know, it was a genuine had a genuine background to it, but just generally we got along fine, and I spent many afternoons, evenings with him.
You say that he acknowledged that there was genuine background to Indian philosophy or religion. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
There's a famous story that Hubbard had.
Now I would question whether it was authentic at all. It's authentic as far as a historical, structure, but as whether it can deliver any goods, that question.
Right. There's a famous legend that Hubbard had a vision, saw an angel or something, back in the early 50s or somewhere. Did he ever talk to you about his angelic vision?
No. But he did say that he had an island that he had purchased that was up in the San Juan someplace, not too far from Seattle or Victoria in that area. And he said he used to fly up there in one of his planes, a seaplane, and he'd take a trip up there under a tree, and the tree would tell him everything that he needed to know.
He would tell you this.
Yeah, that he had used that as his retreat. Uh-huh. He also was taking CO2, too, to when he had sessions with a client, in order to get in rapport with that person, he would take a quick dose of CO2, and that would put him in the close proximity to the individual who was on the psychedelic substance. Usually they were using LSD.
Beg your pardon?
They were using LSD, usually. Sometimes mescaline, but mostly LSD.
What does CO2 do?
Well, it's very similar to a psychedelic experience, but it's very quick, short, just a few minutes.
Right, I see. So that would get him into a similar resonant state with the client.
Yeah.
Okay. Did Stan Collins know Al Hubbard before you or ever?
No,
he didn't. Did Elliot Craig? No.
Yeah. No,
did Elliot Craig know Hubbard? Did Craig and Collins meet Hubbard through you at the center?
No.
Yeah, because
Elliot Craig never came over to the center, ever. We were in contact with him for a short time after that first trip, and Connie bought some electronic gear from him and made a stereo system. And at that time there were just little cheap models of stereo systems at that time, stereo amplifiers. And Connie built some stereo systems and cabinets and put together the speakers and slowly records were getting released in stereo, and we used to have stereo night at the center, which was kind of a social event, and was mostly made up of people that had taken trips. So once they all listened to the music, it was very easy for them to get back in that kind of space, But that Elliot never came over to the center. No, we didn't really care too much for him. There was something funny about him. And he was. I did meet him again later in San Francisco, and spent one evening with him and his wife Connie, and I went to their home, and we took a trip together. And still, there was something strange about Elliot. I never really never really put my finger on it, but we always had sort of a paranoid reaction towards him.
When in natural state of mind or on the drug?
Both.
Yeah, both. So, yeah. Chapter 6 is titled "Friday Night Was Flight Night." Who coined the phrase "flight night"?
Oh, I think maybe Connie. I'm not sure, but there were about four or five of us that were kind of a little group, and we would meet on Friday nights and take a trip together. And Doobie became part of that group towards
Ralph
the end
Doobie.
Of the. Yeah, he moved in. He was a friend of Vivian, Connie's sister, and how she met him and where. Oh, I'm not sure, but she knew him through some contacts, and he was an interesting character. Ralph had been. He was in the Bataan Death March in the Philippines there, survived, ended up in Japan, surviving the that period, and returned to America and had a difficult time getting adjusted. He had, I think, a lot of trauma to go through. He wrote a book called "Oh Lord, Let Me Cry," and I printed it on the printing press we had at the center, and he distributed the book to a number of his friends and so forth.
What was it about?
It was a journal of his experience in Bataan Death March and being incarcerated in a Japanese prison in both the Philippines and Japan.
Didn't the movie The Bridge on the River Kwai come out in 57?
Yeah, I saw that at Paramount Theater in Seattle, Washington.
Yes, Dave Worster talks about the Paramount Theater. Egon Rank, does that name sound familiar? Egon Rank?
Egon Rank.
Yeah.
Rank had a PR company, public relations company. I know he did the public relations for Ben-Hur. That was, that was in maybe about 59 or 60 when it came out. And, but I don't know about the Bridge of the River Kwai. I met
Dave
Rank, Bob Filmon, who was a ventriloquist and a television entertainer, magician. And he came and he stayed at the center. We took him in. He was kind of down and out, had no place to go. Nice fellow, and because of the interest in, he had an interest in psychic phenomena. He was very curious about my experiences, and he was also curious about Keith Reinhardt, and did his own personal investigation about Keith. He was interested in the whole psychic world, you know. As a magician, you become aware of the mediums, and because a lot of the mediums and the magicians aren't so different.
This is Bob Filmon we're talking about. Bob Filmon.
Right. And he introduced me to Egon Rank.
Right. Now, The Bridge Over the River Kwai did come out in 57.
Okay.
All right. So, Ralph, did Ralph Doobie live at the center at any point?
Yeah, he moved in eventually. And there was a third floor on the building, in the house, that was a ballroom. It was a huge room with several other connecting rooms and a kitchen and bathroom and so forth. And Ralph lived there, and I lived on the second floor below him. And Ralph, you know, he came and went. As I told you before, we really were interested in having people that were not connected to the center particularly living there. That was the kind of the technique that I felt was best for survival of the center. So
right,
I didn't want to make an ashram out of it, you know. I was very deadly against that kind of that idea.
You spelled Ralph Doobie. Yeah, you spelled Ralph Doobie, D-U-B-E-Y. Did you do that wrong on purpose, or you didn't know how it was spelled?
Possibly the editors did that. I don't know.
Yeah, I remember it being D-U-B-Y. But he worked at Boeing.
He corrected the manuals. Ralph had a PhD in English Lit. English, yeah. And so he was, articulate and bright, and he had a job there. And so basically, Ralph was a nice guy, very nice guy. And, he introduced me to Japanese food because of his Japanese experience. So,
yeah.
And I introduced Ralph to his first trip, and he thought it was fantastic.
You mentioned Banarsi. He was an Indian who worked at Boeing. Was he a friend of Doobie's?
No, they didn't know each other.
But they would. Yeah.
Not now, at Boeing, they didn't know.
Did Doobie live there at the same time as Worcester?
I don't think so. I think Ralph came after David left.
Well, David was there most of the years, 57 to 60. Unless he...
He was staying with his friends.
He moved out. He moved out eventually.
Yeah.
Okay, so then Doobie shows up. Now, Doobie, it was another aspect. So you've got Shivananda, Banarsi, Doobie, you and Connie. Now, Dave Worcester talked about the ballroom. So when Hubbard would come and visit you, would he stay at the center?
No, he had stayed in a hotel. He had a wife named Rita, and he was flushed. He had money. He had a Rolls Royce car, and he was very proud of that. And he always pulled up in his Rolls, and then we go for a drive and go to a hotel. He was very fond of drinking Jack Daniels, as I recall. And he liked to get pretty loaded.
Right. Did he talk about turning on the political elite of the world, that mission of changing the consciousness of the leaders rather than the Leary method of just sending out to the populace?
Well, we never really talked much about that. He was more interested, it seemed to me, in the psychological area of turning on psychologists, psychiatrists, and religiously inclined people, like Huxley and, Leary, I guess. So, but actually, Leary and Alpert, they got their material long after we had it at the center there. So.
Yes, now Dave Worcester talks about Hubbard was interested in your group taking LSD because it wasn't for therapeutic. You weren't schizoids or apparently alcoholics, and that he was interested in you, the way you people did with that. Do you remember?
He was interested primarily in the mystical experience with us.
Yeah, like what would happen to a healthy person? I mean, a person who's not trying to get cured. The alcoholic might get a religious experience, but it's filtered. It's one step back. He's got to get fixed, so to speak, first. You guys are going straight to the meat of the experience and contemplating it and discussing it. What can you describe what an LSD trip was like for you? I mean, a little bit of detail. Was it the same that everybody else had?
Probably. But I do want to say something. There's fundamentally no difference between a person with problems or who is alcoholic or addicted to drugs or, and is in a hospital setting taking LSD to cure himself of his addiction, than a normal average person also. They have other forms of addiction. psychological stresses, psychological problems of this or that. No, I don't see any fundamental difference between the, you know, an alcoholic and a person who is not an alcoholic. They both have the same problems. Alcoholic has learned to use alcohol as his escape, his drug, to escape his melancholia, you know, his problems. The other individual is just as screwed up, and slightly different. That's all. But my own experience, the first thing I always noticed was that there was some, I could sense some bodily changes, and I could always taste a kind of, sort of like a metallic taste in my palate, you know. And I don't know whether this was psychological or not, but we all seem to have this sort of metallic taste, you know. That might have been a psychological response, you know. But then, very slowly, one was slipping away from the control of thought and slipping into kind of a, you know, a relaxed, bodily relaxed, mental relaxation. And we always provided music, mostly, in the center as a means to induce the journey. And so the music, of course, would become intense and primarily important. And the mood of the music, the kind of music, would set the pace of the experience. We used music primarily in that way as a tool. And Hubbard did too in his therapies and so forth. Hubbard used photos or paintings. I experimented with paintings and things, images, statues. You know, we had a Buddha, and we had some Catholic paintings of Christ and etc. And they would induce, you know, either a Christian or a Buddhist kind of experience. But like in the case of Banarsi, my Indian friend, I didn't give him any symbolism. I just played some. Maybe I played Indian music for him. I had a little at that time, very little. I had some Uday Shankar records. I was a brother of Ravi Shankar, who came before Ravi. And he described seeing Shiva, the Lord of Destruction, the creator of the... He destroyed and created at the same moment. And he talked a lot about that. And also, he sort of about physics. He was interested in physics, so about how he saw the universe, and experience, and so forth. But back to my encounter with the LSD. Well, we normally would lie down on the floor. It was a heavily carpeted, beautiful room that we had. Very large room with large stereo speakers at one end. The lights were always soft. And just lie there, listen to the music, and space out for 2 or 3 hours. Sometimes we would chat together, talk, but mostly we just lie down and just have our own personal experience, as it were. With Ralph, there was lots of interaction because we were kind of leading him, showing him what he could do under the influence of LSD, which direction he could do, what he could do. He could go up, he could go down, he could go, you know. Wherever he wanted to go, he could go. Whatever he wanted to imagine, he could imagine. So he quickly caught on and immediately began to play with it and experience all the variety of experiences that one can have under the influence of a drug like this, which gives you access to one's unconscious into that vast storehouse of memories that belong to mankind. I remember one time we had an experience with Shivaram, who was a dancer, Indian dancer from Kerala. He was staying at the center, and he danced for us and under LSD. And that was quite interesting because suddenly I was transported to India, and all the gestures, the mudras that he was doing, I understood. You grasped the meaning of them, or at least you thought you did, but it seemed that I was correct. and instant rapport with anyone, instant feeling of oneness, no separation whatsoever. I even had an experience with Biff, the chimpanzee, under LSD, feeling absolutely at one with him, and knowing what it was to be a chimpanzee. It was a very interesting experience. We were outside, outside sitting in the lawn, and he was showing me a bumblebee that was flying around some clover. And I suddenly saw that he was communicating to me, you know. He was pointing his finger at the bumblebee and chirping and making chip sounds that I realized that he was saying, be careful. Yeah. He knew about bumblebees. So I knew what it was to, you know, to be an animal, you know. And of course, we are animals. That's all we are. We're just educated. That's all.
Okay, then, did you feel that, did you get the messianic or the messenger aspect of Hubbard and Leary, that you wanted more and more people to experience this? Did you feel that, boy, it'd be great if everybody had this experience? Did you think that way?
No, not so much.
Yeah. You did not think it had to go out, and you didn't think it would cure the world's problems like Leary and Hubbard seemed to think.
No. My father and my stepmother wanted to take it. They heard me. I talked to them about it, and they took it. And they're from, you know, straight background, you know. It did transform my father for somewhat. He was really taken by it. And my stepmother was, at first she resisted, and then I played Mahalia Jackson, the gospel singer album.
Yeah.
And I took her into a religious fantasy trip, and she was thrilled by the experience. And afterwards, we went to a botanical garden at the in a park nearby the center there, Volunteer Park, where the art museum is, and there's a botanical garden. And we walked through it. My father was looking at all the flowers and saying, they're alive, they're alive. Of course they're alive, but we didn't know how alive. I could see that this definitely had, you know, more effect on a person than doing yoga for 5 years, you know. They could instantly, you know, get into a altered state. And so I saw that was an immense boon or help, you know, if a person was interested in these kind of experiences. But like Agananda said, he said, I like these experiences. This is what I'm interested in. He said, and therefore they have a value to me. So whether they were the cure-all that Hubbard seemed to feel, or Leary tried to initiate, I don't know. One can go only as far as one can go, and the drugs will take you part way, but you have to have some initiative on your part. I know that Yuji, I talked to him in 1966 about LSD, and
Yuji Krishnamurti. We're talking about Yuji Krishnamurti.
Yeah, in London, he said he took it. And he said, and he talked later on about being headless, in a headless state. And I often think that he was referring to the LSD experience. But I'm not sure. He never would, you know, after 1966, someone asked him again, had he ever taken LSD or any psychic drugs or taken bong or hemp, you know, in India, and he said no. And I said, oh, come on, Yuji, you told me you did. He looked at me kind of sheepishly. Like, shh, don't tell him. I think his reasoning behind that, I often thought, why do you say that? Well, he didn't want anyone to think they had to do that to get where he is.
Yeah.
He often didn't want to talk about his own experiences, his physical experiences, because then he said, well, people will think they have to have those same physical experiences. And he said, and they don't. They don't necessarily need that. Or he didn't even go so far as to say need that. They don't need, you know, they don't think, they will fabricate those experiences and project them and think they're getting somewhere.
Okay, now what, did you ever, go ahead.
Go ahead, no.
Did you take ecstasy or other drugs later, and how would you compare them to LSD?
Oh, I took ecstasy in Seattle, Washington, but that was in like in 69 or 70, something like in that period of time.
Yeah.
It was nowhere near the intensity of LSD. So.
Did you ever do cocaine?
Yeah, I tried cocaine. I thought it was I didn't care for it.
Right. Did you ever do heroin?
No.
Okay. So for you, LSD was the most...
LSD was the most... And the mushrooms were the most significant kind of substances that I took.
The most intense.
I took a lot of LSD. I took a lot of LSD. We were taking it once a week for over a period of a year. So figure it out, you know. And then when I came back from India, the hip friends were all taking LSD. It's real common, you know. If you went to a party or you went to a concert, you took LSD. And I continued to take it occasionally, but not a lot after India. I tapered off.
Only Which is 1966, 67 is India.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah.
Did you only use
Seattle,
your...
No, by that time there was a window pane, and which was Osley's LSD, I think. He was making that. I'm not sure, but little pills were available that Osley was manufacturing. And they were very strong. They were like 200 mics each, you know, at least. They got you there. They got it, no question about it. I didn't see
Did
any qualitatively difference, you know, in the LSD. There were lots of LSD-like pills going around that weren't LSD. They were, you know, they were ecstasy and strychnine and God knows what else they were putting in there to give someone a trip. But I preferred to know what I was taking, basically.
Did you... Mushrooms, you thought what?
Were very good. The most, you know, they weren't as harsh and hard as the LSD experience. There was a certain hardness to the LSD compared to mushrooms. It seemed more groovy and more. You felt more relaxed and didn't seem to have any anxiety at all. Under LSD, you could trip in and out of different levels of sometimes be anxious about something, then get over it. I remember one time I was an artist of sorts, and I did a lot of painting during that time, a lot of paintings. And I had painted a kind of mythological goddess, Mithra, the goddess, Greek goddess, and it was kind of a psychedelic painting I made. And I had I looked at that painting under LSD one night, and I noticed that the painting started to fragment. It started coming apart. All the different levels and textures and designs and colors and images all started disconnecting, and the painting was falling apart. But I realized that I was falling apart, and I was coming to an end. And I remember how frightening that experience of coming to an end is, and how we do not want to come to an end. We will go up to a certain point, but we will come to full stop. Because if we come to an end, that's the end of it. It's the end of me. So what happened, though, I did come to an end, and I was thrown into a cosmic vortex of energy that was expanding and collapsing on itself. A tremendous expanse, and then a collapse into the center and out again. And this was sort of a mystical kind of experience that I was having. And there was great ecstasy and great joy and insight into that experience. But it's a mystical experience. It's something that belongs to our culture, our background. No doubt I was in some kind of universal state of mind, not east or west, but beyond that the primary states of consciousness. But still, it in order to recognize that experience, to have any kind of conceptual experience of what was taking place, that had to exist before. And I didn't want to admit that, you know, that I was experiencing someone else's experience. You follow?
Yeah, no, very interesting. Yeah. I had a thought. You said that in that experience, the me did come to an end, but the me was still experiencing the cosmic pulse.
Yeah.
Point after that? Is there a point after that which you didn't experience because you weren't me anymore?
There's memory. There's memory of what happened, you know.
Is the cosmic pulse the memory?
And I think that memory is there all the time anyway. Even in the case of a so-called, quote, enlightened man, the memory is there. But the memory doesn't interfere with one's perception.
Right, but are you saying the cosmic pulse experience was a memory of you ending? That was the after image or the...
Well, I ended, and then what? I ended, and then what happened? There was this explosion. A new dimension opened up. Not the dimension of Robert Carr, you know, and being sitting in Seattle, Washington, looking at a painting. That was gone. There was just this intense experience of seeing how the cosmos operates, you know. What's going on?
The archetypal or basic pattern of in and out or pulsing in and out seems to be the universal movement that is elaborated in nature in different forms and spiraling improvisations from, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, the breathing.
You're right. The in and
the
out.
The breath. Don't they go, I'm the breath?
Yeah.
I'm the breathing? So your image of your me died, and a new image of me, a huge image, or a intense image of me.
Yeah,
so you're saying, right, so it was ecstatic after you got through the fear.
Yeah. I think this is common with everybody.
Yeah, that is a common experience, and it is and you may be right. U.G. Krishnamurti wanted people to get beyond the significance of replaying the universal pulse feeling that anybody that's all one could get as a mind, as thought. That's the only point it gets.
Yeah. The point is this: if we're talking about U.G., he doesn't land on any one experience. It's there and gone. He doesn't hold on to it. So.
Yeah.
And it's very, very fast and very rapid. You know, it's beyond the movement of thought. It's this much higher speed going on. Just, there's a pulse in life. The energy is happening at such a tremendous speed. And you don't land any one place. You don't hold on to any one experience. The moment you do, you're stuck. Then you become religious. You interpret it. And then you think something's happened to you and you try and relate it to others. And if you're, you know, religiously inclined, to spread the gospel, then you try and, you know, you try and become a, you become a religious teacher then. I was in a bookstore yesterday. We went to a movie at a mall here in India, and I was looking at a book by Eckhart Tolle, a new book, yeah. So I looked at it. First thing I noticed was it was double-spaced, and I thought, oh, trying to get more pages.
Yeah.
Yeah, cheapy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Trying to make it look better than it was. So I just scanned, you know, skimmed through it, scanning real quickly, and I just said, yeah, the guy is selling mystical experiences, you know?
And yeah.
You know, he's just selling a new version of the same old stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Just a new dress, new form. And it's not new, really. No, no, it's just repeating slightly different words, but just a repetition. I thought, Jesus, you know. And the next tour was by some guy named Sharma. He's from Canada. He's written a book on how to be happy. he's in India right now giving courses, you know. And I thought, you know, just hustlers, that's all. Just hustlers. Selling. You want to make money. Okay, that's okay.
Yeah, when I've seen a couple of Eckhart Tolle books, and I don't get past the title. The title is so cliche, I know where it's going.
Yeah.
So I've never looked inside one of them.
Yeah. But, I've been tainted.
Yes. So you got this whole backlog of Indian culture that you have that can become nostalgic and sentimental and a memory, and you got to overcome that every time. Present.
Yeah.
When you talk about this rapidity of non-thought experience, don't you think it's interesting that for the collectivity on the planet, we are experiencing that in our media, that kind of speed?
Well, you know, everything's going faster. You know, everything is moving faster and faster. And it's becoming, you know, sound bites. just little minute bits of information that can go in any direction. It's being manipulated. That's the sadness of it. It's being manipulated by the government and by the powers that are controlling the government. And